I'm Rick Dedarian, and this is Realms of Memory. Ask 10 people why we should remember the past, and at least one person is going to tell you so we don't repeat it. Now, they might not know who George Santa Anna is, the 19th century Spanish-American philosopher who came up with the saying, "Those who forget the past are doomed to repeat it," but they share his conviction that we can and should learn from remembering the past. This is the conviction that inspired me to take up this podcast over 3 years ago. It's a conviction that was reinforced by the very first conversation I had with author Susan Neiman about her book, Learning from the Germans, Race and the Memory of Evil. Susan argues that the Germans did learn from remembering the past, and as a result, they became a much more trusted and trustworthy nation, a leader in Europe. In her book, Susan takes to task another author who argues the exact opposite. David Reif, in his book In Praise of Forgetting, Historical Memory and Its Ironies, argues that we rarely learn from the past and we're often better off forgetting. Reif's views are informed by a long career as a journalist covering many of the world's worst conflicts. His writings have appeared in major publications from the New York Times to the New Republic. He's been featured in radio and TV interviews, and he's written a score of books. And for a long time, I've been hoping to feature a conversation with him about his book, In Praise of Forgetting. I'm very happy to be able to share a conversation I had with him back in January 2025. When is it better to forget? A conversation with David Reif about his book, In Praise of Forgetting, Historical Memory and Its Ironies.
I'm David Reif. I'm a writer and a journalist and sometime policy analyst, sometime humanitarian consultant. I've written lots and lots of books on all sorts of subjects, from humanitarian aid to war in Bosnia to American cities like Los Angeles and Miami. And I wrote some years ago a book called In Praise of Forgetting, which is an argument that basically, not that it's always better to forget than to remember, but that there's no reason to sacralize memory. There's no reason to say, as so many people do nowadays, taking off from a famous remark by a Spanish-American philosopher of the early part of the 20th century, that those who forget the past are condemned to repeat it. I'm not sure that's true. I'm not sure we learn anything from the past, but that may be a separate conversation. But the argument I make is simply that sometimes it's better to remember, indeed, and sometimes it's too dangerous to remember. And by memory, what I mean by remembrance, we're talking about not individual memory, not what people have experienced, which, of course, they're not going to forget, nor should they be asked to. But what we do with memory in public, in political life, in societies. So if you say to remember in that context, you're talking about public memory, public commemoration. And if you're talking about forgetting, you're talking about public silence, the lack of commemoration. And I think sometimes one is preferable and sometimes the other is. But given the fact that it's virtually a sacred precept among well-intended, decent people, that it's always better to remember. The book I wrote had a certain amount of, people felt stung by it, let's say, in a lot of cases. A good example, though, might be to talk about what I've spent a great deal of my life experiencing, writing about, thinking about, covering as a journalist, et cetera, which are wars. And when there's a victor, a clear victor, it's possible to impose a memory on everybody, the victorious and the defeated. But very few wars end the way, World War II ended in the Pacific with the Japanese signing articles of unconditional surrender aboard a battleship and then being occupied for quite a while. Most wars end in messy stalemates, different kinds of bad deals for everybody, in which there is no consensus. So a good example of a place where I think they were right not to insist on remembrance was Northern Ireland. In Northern Ireland, after, well, almost 100 years of struggle for independence, when the period of low-grade civil war in the north of the province, the part of Ireland that's still British, still under the rule of the crown, when peace was finally cobbled out, largely through the efforts of an American senator, George Mitchell, it would have been impossible to get any kind of consensus about memory. The Protestants and the Catholics, or if you prefer, the Unionists and the Republicans, were never going to agree on either what happened or who was in the right. And neither side were defeated. So what was the alternative? You could have public commemorations, which inevitably would piss off one side or another, and just lead you back to tension and maybe even for the outbreak of the war again. Or everyone could keep their mouths shut publicly, think what they thought in their communities, kind of gloss it over in student textbooks, and try to get on with things, to think about the future without thinking so much about the past. And I think that was a very good decision in Ireland. Now, that doesn't mean it would have been a good decision in Argentina after the fall of the dictatorship. It's a case-by-case thing. But again, my argument is basically you've got to weigh these things in terms of how dangerous remembering is and how dangerous forgetting is. And sometimes I think, or at least I argue, you're going to find out that remembering is more dangerous. There was a negotiator early on in the Irish Troubles, a very interesting scholar and politician and diplomat called Conor Cruise O'Brien. And he wrote a memoir of negotiating with both sides. He was official of the Republic, but negotiating in the North. And he said every time they got close to an agreement, one side or another would remember one of those effing songs, that is, militant songs that inspired everybody, whether on the Catholic side it was the rising of the moon, or whether on the Protestant side it was the orange sash my father wore, etc. And then the negotiations would fall apart, O'Brien said. Now, I think it's better that people put those songs in the drawer. We're talking in the middle of the horrors of Gaza. Now, let's imagine, for the sake of argument, I admit it doesn't seem very likely at this moment, that one day there were peace between the Israelis and the Palestinians. They're never going to agree about the past. Absent, you know, Jesus Christ returning to tell everybody what they should do, which, given the fact that there are a few Christians among them, probably wouldn't even work on that basis. That's a joke. But, you know, unless there were some extraplanetary authority or the second coming or I don't know what, to say you guys were wrong, the other guys were right, or vice versa, they're going to have to agree to disagree about the past, however painful that is, no matter what's happened. Or they're going to have to fight on till one side or the other wins an absolute victory. Those are the two choices if you're going to remember. And again, maybe sometimes fighting on till victory is the best solution. But in my view, at least, having seen a lot of wars as a journalist, I think that's rarely a good solution. So I think everyone says this is a terrible peace or an unjust peace, and we've heard that in so many different, you know, ends of war periods. But I think the silencing of the guns is such a great accomplishment in and of itself that if you don't also get to have your version of history be the one that everyone accepts, that seems to me a not such a terrible price to pay often. Now, again, in a situation, for example, in Latin America, in Argentina or Chile or Uruguay, where there were periods of dictatorship, some fairly short, one in Chile quite long, 21 years, you had a consensus after the end of the dictatorships that people wanted to know what happened. They wanted to remember. They wanted the people who'd been tortured to get some kind of recognition of what had really happened. And obviously the families of the people who'd been murdered by the various dictatorships to be recognized, for the facts to be recognized. And there was a consensus in those societies after the end of the dictatorships that they wanted to remember. And memory politics is still incredibly powerful in the countries I'm talking about, in Argentina, in the southern cone of Latin America, in Argentina, Chile, and Uruguay. But that, if you like, is the other extreme from the Northern Irish case that I mentioned, or my kind of speculations about Israel-Palestine. And probably there'll be some, how would one put it? There'll be cases in the middle where people will want to forget for a while, and then they'll decide they want to remember. Or they'll remember a lot, and then they'll start forgetting, because in the end, if an event is long enough ago, I don't want to depress your audience, but I mean, remember, in the long run, everything will be forgotten. Not just us, little people, but all our civilization. I think it's a safe bet. I mean, I don't know if humanity will last 100 years, let alone another 10,000, but it's a safe bet that if humanity were to last another 10,000 years, 1,000 or 2,000 years from now, all of the political arrangements we know will not exist. So it's not as if things will be remembered eternally. That's a metaphysical idea. That's a religious idea. And that can be eternal. I mean, I'm not myself a person of faith, but I have a lot of respect for that. But that's the whole point of religious faith is it's out of time. But if you're in time, well, of course, everything will be forgotten. So if that's true, which I believe incontrovertibly it is, we are just talking about when, not if. So we should be free to forget if we as societies think that that's safer for us. And my
argument was kind of a, so when you started talking about geological time in your book, this grand sweep of time, I couldn't help thinking of this Steven Spielberg movie I had seen called AI, Artificial Intelligence.
Yes, I saw.
You know, you go into the future and it's after some kind of environmental disaster, and you fast forward into the distant future, and the only memory of the human species are robots, and they've recovered this kind of android robot, and they're trying to recover his memory. I found it to be an incredibly depressing movie because there are only these fragments of the traces, the remnants of the memory of humankind that are left that these robots are discovering. But essentially, that's what you're saying with geological time. You're saying if you look at the grand sweep of the history of the universe, we're here for only a blink of an eye or even less. And I kind of read that as a message to, you know, get over yourself, get real. I mean, as I read through your whole book, I kept on hearing this. Let's look at things realistically. We're too caught up in the here and now. We're not really looking at the big picture. We're caught up in our, you know, petty, we're either caught up in utopian thinking that isn't realistic, or we're too fixated on the trees. We're not seeing the bigger picture. And we need to really set that aside to, if we're ever going to make the most of the here and now. I mean, if we're ever going to get over our differences and make the best of what we have now.
Yeah, well, I certainly think that's true. I think, look, I've written somewhere or other, I can't remember where, that it's never a bad thing to, you know, understand how insignificant you are, even the most important people. And we even know the careers of important people. There was a British politician of the 1960s who once said, it seems to me very accurately, that all political careers end in failure. That is, eventually you're repudiated by your audience. Look at Joe Biden, this extraordinary career of political success in all kinds of ways, as a senator, as a incredibly influential vice president, one of the few, as a president. And now, you know, all people think about is why, you know, he didn't get out earlier. And everybody, that happens to in life, that happens to the proudest people, are humbled eventually, if not before, then by death. Thinking of oneself a little bit more humbly would be a very good thing. Whether people are capable of it, you know, that's for the psychiatrists.
No, we're caught up in historical time. I mean, for better or worse, we think in historical time.
Well, you can't not. I mean, because otherwise you'd just, you know, sit on a rock and, you know, because, of course, if you think entirely in geological time, you wouldn't care about your family. You wouldn't care about your friends. You have to think in historical time, but I think you need to be, if you like, more conscious, even if it's just, you know, the ghost staring over your right shoulder, about geological time, because, look, one of the great problems in all civilizations is pride. And pride gets things built, but pride also, as the Bible says, leads to a fall. And it's both things. But look, these are the meta question, the geological question, is of course something you need to be conscious of. But I'm actually making an argument inside historical time. I think that we have fetishized the duty to remember out of a combination, for lots of good intentions, by the way. I don't think people have done this out of some either stupidity or morally questionable or ethically questionable intention. I think people have done it because they hope the past, which is so horrible, can teach the present some lessons so the horror isn't repeated, all the rest of it. But there's actually very little evidence for that. There's very little evidence for the fact that having the experience of one horror prevents another. I mean, look at the phrase never again, which I'm interested in in historical terms. The phrase never again derives from some prisoners in one of the liberated German concentration camps in 1945, who made a sign, these liberated prisoners, survivors, and it said never again. And that became a great slogan for ethically minded, decent people, quite understandably. But there's absolutely no evidence that the murder of the Jews and gypsies, Jews and Roma in the Nazi period has prevented any subsequent genocide. There's absolutely no evidence for this. People, when the Rwandan genocide happened or the Cambodian genocide happened, or if you consider Gaza a genocide, I sort of go back and forth on whether I think that's right or not. Don't know that I really have the legal ability to, but it's a horror of unbelievable proportion. I say to myself, did Auschwitz and those camps teach anyone anything? Doesn't look that way. People don't tend to think about the past when they're killing other people.
Wasn't this part of your criticism that you have these intellectuals like Santayana who are trying to make a case for how we can learn from the past, but they have a fundamental misunderstanding of the relationship between the past and the present?
Yeah. Well, they think, first of all, when they talk about the past, they tend to be talking about the past of things they went through. And maybe it's true that if you lived through the horrors of Europe between 1939 and 1945, you wouldn't repeat that. But then history doesn't repeat itself in that sense. I mean, certain crimes are committed over and over again. But sure, will Germans ever kill Jews and gypsies again? No. If that's all you mean by learn by the past, you don't, it won't be repeated. But other peoples will try to exterminate other peoples. And that's what we know. We saw it in Rwanda as a perfect example of an attempt literally to kill every last member of one of the two constituent peoples of that country. Sort of what the Germans had, what the Nazis had in mind with the Jews and the Roma. They wanted to kill every last one. Genocide is a legal concept, and I'm not competent to judge that because they're in the concept as a legal construct. There are notions of, it doesn't have to be completely exterminationist. There are all kinds of categories where you can, attempt to destroy another people's culture, lots of other ways in which it qualifies as genocide. But if we're talking about exterminatory war, well, I don't know a single example of a war of that kind that's been stopped because people remember some previous barbarity. First of all, I think Santayana, God bless him, assumed that people were better than they are. That'd be one thing I'd say. Not because people are evil. Again, I spend half my life trying to say that I'm not trying to replace one absolute with another. If people aren't all good, that doesn't mean they're all bad. What it basically means, I suspect, is that some people are really evil and some people are really good and most people are in between and sort of, you know, tend to try to get by. And if they're in decent societies, they're more likely to behave decently. And if they're in very cruel societies, they're likely to behave more cruelly. Not because they're so terrible, but just because most people are just trying to survive. There was an American writer called Gore Vidal, probably forgotten nowadays, who used to talk about getting on his high horse that he always kept tethered nearby. Well, I don't have a high horse tethered nearby, and I don't, you know, it's not for me to judge other people who are trying to survive these unspeakable societies like Stalin's Russia or Pol Pot's Vietnam. If they collaborated, you know, who am I to judge them? I didn't go through it. But I think that the idea that people, if only they would sort of learn the lessons of history, this is a kind of fantasy of rationality and of the importance of pedagogy that just doesn't reflect reality. Most mass murder takes place in moments of great fear, whether that fear is authentic or that fear is constructed, you know. But, you know, the Germans said the Jews were a disease that Europe had to extirpate. The Rwandan Hutus said more or less the same thing about the Rwandan Tutsis, whom they called cockroaches. Stations, if you like, was their what they meant. Most of these events are undertaken out of fear, and fear is not a rational emotion. And it can't be undone just by saying, well, that's very irrational to be afraid of this or of that. We're a sum of our passions and fears, as well as other things that are maybe better. So I'm, you know, my views are always, you know, as prudential as possible. I just want the fewest people to suffer. And I think that utopian fantasies about, which I consider learning from history to be a utopian fantasy, to be honest. I don't think that's the way that you make societies less cruel.
But if you look at the trajectory of your own thinking, my sense is that, I mean, you've mentioned this in other interviews, that you get to Bosnia, you cover that war, and you were a card-carrying member of the Santayana Club up to that point in time, and made that experience change your thinking. So what was it about that? And I've heard the story about your trip to Belgrade during the war. But was there more that happened on the ground, your interactions and how you saw the memories of the past being used that really challenged your own thinking at the time?
Sure. Oh yeah, I was absolutely, that's a fair comment. I was absolutely a member of the Santayana Brigade. I mean, I don't think I thought about it in a very profound way, to be honest with you. One way or the other, I just think I had sort of drunk the, you know, from the water supply that I grew up in, which was America from, you know, in mid Latin latter part of the 20th century. So I thought those things, and then Bosnia was a tremendous wake up call. I probably should have thought of it earlier. It probably reflects, because I was almost 40 when I went to Bosnia. I should have, and I'd been around the block a few times. It wasn't my first war, and it wasn't the first situation of humanitarian disaster that I'd been in by any means. But yeah, Bosnia was an easy place to focus, though, because the conflict was put by both sides so much in historical terms, historical wounds, historical injuries, the revival of historical perils. The Serbs viewed, you know, the propaganda of the Serbs was to speak of the Bosnian Muslims as sort of new Ottoman invasion of Europe. So one learned on the ground that how toxic history could be, and how easily memory could be abused. Now, people who've disagreed with me, there was a wonderful Bulgarian French philosopher and writer called Svetan Todorov. He was a great friend of mine, died many years ago, who was very interested in memory, and he didn't agree with me at all. And he basically said, what you're describing is true. I mean, he didn't deny any of it. He said, you know, that's an abuse of memory, and there's a decent use of memory. And, you know, obviously he was an incredibly smart man, and I learned a lot. But he may be right. I don't think he is, though, because I think they're just too easily confused. So that, you know, history turns into a weapon a lot of the time in these situations. And the fact that maybe a good historian, would deny this popular use of history. Yeah, but that's not going to have any effect. I mean, that assumes that was Santayana's problem. He really thought, you know, smart, rational, kind people could sort of lead the masses out of their darkness. It seems like a very old-fashioned idealist idea. But he was a very brilliant man, so, you know, who am I in a certain sense? But I don't see it. I think use and abuse of memory are just too close too often. So, yeah, in Bosnia, people kept telling you stories about what happened in 1389 and what happened in 1453. And you were expected to... This was supposed to be some kind of license or moral warrant or political warrant for what they were doing. And in the end, it just became a justification for killing. So I think, you know, looking backwards can be very dangerous. Now, again, you know, I don't want to make it simple. It was a very good thing that the truth was established about what happened in the dictatorship in Chile. There was a consensus to go for it. not a whole consensus. There was certainly a part of the population that was loyal to the dictatorship and didn't think the dictatorship had been so terrible. And there are probably a lot of people who pretended they were now against the dictatorship who hadn't been so against it while it was still powerful. But there was still a substantial majority, sizable majority, that really wanted the truth to come out. And in that context, it was absolutely better to remember. There was no serious risk involved. And so I'm all for that. And there are cases...
Collective memory, and you go to great pains to explaining what is collective memory, that this is not the same thing. You argue that it's not even memory. You really need to understand what it is to really understand the dangers of it. So that was something I was hoping you'd elaborate on, and how collective memory is very different from what you refer to as critical history. But I understand this is almost like an unexploded device, and you really need to treat it very carefully, understand the dangers, understand, you know, you need to cut the red wire or the green wire, know what you're dealing with, and have competent people to deal with that. But you are very careful to explain, because, you know, you use a title like In Praise of Forgetting, and naturally people are going to, you know, think that you're arguing for blanket forgetting.
Yeah.
So you go to great pains to explaining, no, this is not the case, that there are certain conditions in which remembering is appropriate. And you've already explained that, well, there's certain contexts where there's a consensus. You also explain how there's a certain time frame. There are certain types of histories where it's appropriate to retain these things in collective memory. And also there's a certain time frame where it's appropriate to remember, and after which, you know, regardless, it might be better to leave that in the past. So I was hoping you could elaborate a little bit about what is collective memory? Why is it such a dangerous thing? How is it so different from critical history? And what are the conditions? And again, you've mentioned a little bit about this, in which it is appropriate to collectively remember difficult histories.
Yeah. Well, I mean, the first thing to say, I mean, before getting to the issue of collective versus individual memory or collective memory, whatever that is simply that things have timestamps on them. We don't necessarily know what that timestamp is, but they have timestamps on them. We're not going to feel, the United States is a very, relatively young country, and probably the timestamp isn't on anything that's happened in the U.S. yet, not least because slavery is the kind of foundational wound of this country. This country has many glories, but it has this terrible foundational wound. And it's probably, I mean, nobody thinks that, I'm not a fan of the 1619 project and all of this sort of revisionist.
How about the 1776 one?
Yeah, I prefer that one, frankly, for all its faults, infinitely prefer it. But I think, you know, pretending that victims' history is, you know, is if anything, it may even be worse than kind of official glorifying history. I'm not at all persuaded it's an improvement. First of all, because it robs people of their agency. They just become victims and the descendants of victims and the rest. But there are plenty of societies that are older than ours where at a certain point, the thing becomes past its sell-by date. You know, if you run a little grocery store, you have to throw it back out in the dumpster. I'll give you a dumb example, but it's an obvious one, which is, you know, the conquest of England by the Normans in 1066. Well, you can't get anyone upset about the conquest of Britain by the Normans in 1066 because it's past its sell-by date. And yet, for hundreds of years, the distinction between Norman and Anglo-Saxon in British society was absolutely fundamental. If you read Walter Scott's novel, Ivanhoe, you'll discover that, you know, he was interested in history and he had a particular view of history, but he portrays these two aristocracies, the one that had been done the conquering, the Normans, and the one that had been conquered, the English or the Anglo-Saxons or whatever you want to call them. And for hundreds of years, that was really a living wound in English history. At some point, it won't be. It wasn't. A country, I spent a lot of time in Ireland. I love Ireland, and I know it fairly well. And what's been fascinating going to Ireland over the last 40 years, which I've done, is the transformation of Ireland into a European country. It was a very peculiar, special place, sort of trapped between Britain and the U.S. And then it joined the European Union, and it became a EU country, including having immigrants from the Third World coming there and, you know, and with all the social problems that that creates. And it's a European country. The more European it gets, the less its terrible past is going to be relevant to its present or its future. Probably a good thing, by the way, on balance. I mean, there are problems. You know, there were problems with the old Ireland and there are problems with the new Ireland. I don't think the country's in such terrible shape. I think it's probably a better country as a European country than it was as a thing by itself. An EU country is what I mean by that. At some point, thinking about the crimes Cromwell committed when he sent his armies to Ireland and massacred people in various cities, most famously in Drogheda, that made more sense to a young Irish person than it does today. Young Irish person today is looking at Brussels or looking at, you know, at some point, things get dropped. And when it happens, you can't tell. It could last a very long time or last a very short time, comparatively speaking, in historical terms. As far as memory goes, look, there's no such thing as collective memory in any kind of... that's just a fact. There is individual memory. There may be some traumatic inheritance. Some people say there is. I'm a little skeptical, but there are serious neurologists who say that traumatized populations can hand on trauma for a while. But again, whether that's neurological or whether that's cultural in the sense of you tell stories about how you've been oppressed or you've suffered, and that becomes, if you like, folk memory. I'm even skeptical of that, but that's at least possible. But there's no such thing as collective memory. What collective memory is a consensus among a population, a society, about what happened in the past. And first of all, that's fluid. And second, it largely speaking is more of an emotion than a scientific inquiry. You're remembering the wounds. There was a famous Polish poet, Czesław Miłosz, who said, "It's possible there's no other memory than the memory of wounds." But that's a metaphorical way of speaking of the world. There is no memory in that sense. What there is each society at given points in its history rewriting the past in large measure to suit the political, social, cultural aims of the present. I mean, if you think of American history and the various ways in which it's been taught in school books for the last 200 years or more than 200 years, you'll see how much it changes and how much it's rewritten to suit what's viewed as the national consensus of the moment. Sometimes it's rewritten, and then the rewriting disappears. I think we're having that a little bit with the American Civil War, which when I was born and young, the narrative of the war between brothers, you know, where there were really no good guys or bad guys. There were, of course, slavery was bad, but, you know, the noble lost cause of the South. I mean, I was, how old was I? I was 8 years old at the time of the centennial of the beginning of the 1961, at the beginning of the 100-year anniversary of the beginning of the firing on Fort Sumter. I was, you know, you had, you know, blue hats and gray hats that were sort of sold equally in American toy shops to young kids, including, by the way, young black kids. I remember, as if it were yesterday, my best friend in elementary school at the time, it was a African-American kid who was the son of a colleague of my father's in California. He kept asking his parents why he couldn't have a gray hat. It was that sublimated or assimilated into, so a, you know, upper middle class black kid who'd grown up in a, you know, non-segregated part of the world, part of America, could actually ask that question. And, you know, sort of was gently told he'd better get a blue one. But you see, that version was not the accepted version right after the Civil War. On the contrary, the veterans of the Union Army were incredibly bitter about the extent to which the South was being allowed to sort of raise statues to its heroes, whom the veterans of the Union Army had bled to defeat, and the monuments that went up in praise of the South, or, you know, praise of the Confederate cause, including even that amusement park in Georgia, Stone Mountain. And now it's changing. Now, as a result of a historical shift, all these bases that were named after Confederate generals are having their names changed by, I believe, order of Congress. I doubt President Trump, whatever he does to undo the acts of his predecessors, will put Braxton Bragg's name back on Fort Bragg or such things. It surprised me enormously if that happened. I personally think it's a very good thing that these names are removed, not because I'm anti-military, quite the opposite. I'm pretty pro-military, but I don't see why traitors to the Republic should have bases named after them. I never did.
That seems like a particular case where you're saying most wars end up in messy conflict, messy compromises, that you don't have a clear-cut winner or loser, that makes the importance of putting, you know, memories that are often connected to wounds in the past. But in that case, you have a clear-cut winner, and maybe peace eventually
but that's not what
out of letting the losing side tell the story.
Well, but they're two different questions. I mean, one is not taking sanctions against the losing side. I mean, I think Lincoln was quite right not to insist on, I don't know, shooting Lee or, you know, or whatever. My own view is there are two separate questions. One is truth and the other is sanction. I mean, after all, we've had a very important Truth and Reconciliation Commission where there were no sanctions, and that's South Africa. I mean, Nelson Mandela decided that the dangers, I mean, this is a perfect example of the kind of prudential thinking that I rather idolize, I guess, in my book. Mandela said to his aide, some of whom wanted these Afrikaner generals and police officials and the rest shot, or at least jailed. He said, no, it's too risky, that we could start the war all over again. We finally got peace. We have our government. If they tell the truth at these hearings about what they did, they can go home in time for dinner. And they did, most of them. Very few of them refused to talk. And none of them, as far as I know, who I don't believe that, I believe the South African government entirely kept its word, and that anyone who confessed was indeed given told that there would be no further prosecution, no prosecution. And I think that's a, you know, that's really a kind of adult way of thinking about things, which I wish there were more of in this world. But Mandela was a very special figure, of course, very remarkable.
Well, you're realizing what you're airing. You've got an opportunity to discuss what happened with the realization that if you try to go beyond that, the consequences are not going to be worth the price.
Exactly.
At least you allow the airing of that. And whether that's beneficial or not, I guess you think it is to even go that far.
I think one owes the truth to the victims. In other words, I mean, I think if you can set up, there are two extreme cases. Let's say there's Argentina, where the really overwhelming consensus in society was that what happened had to be revealed, and that sanctions, prison terms, et cetera, had to be levied against the perpetrators, or at least a lot of the perpetrators. And then there's Ireland, where it was decided that there was just no way of having these trials to speak of, and everyone was going to have to just get on with the future and the present and the future. And there was, there were these gunmen who were going to go free. Hell, I mean, one of the two principal figures in the Northern Irish government after the war had been the head of the IRA's military wing, of the IRA, Sinn Féin's military wing, to be accurate. Martin McGuinness, a gunman of, killed a lot of people, Martin McGuinness, including a lot of innocent people, but with bombings and the like. But he was either the deputy first minister or the deputy and the Protestant leader of one of the Protestant paramilitaries was the first minister. They decided to do it that way. And in the middle, you get South Africa, where Mandela wanted the truth told, but he thought prudentially sanctioning people would be too dangerous. And we're all moving, when you think about these issues, you have to think which of these three possibilities is more important. In the case of the American South, after all, none of this happened until the failure of Reconstruction. It's not as if right after the war ended, after Appomattox, that the decision was made that to make this sort of myth where the South had been a kind of lost noble cause and the rest. Quite the contrary, there was a military occupation of the South. And it was really only when Southern votes were needed to support Hayes in 1874, that the South was in effect given permission to reimpose its version of apartheid, which after all is what it was, and went from there. And a lot of the monuments, remember, historically speaking, a lot of the Confederate monuments, memorabilia, and the rest were actually put up in the American South during the Civil Rights Movement. For example, the battle flag of the old Confederacy never hung over the State House in Mississippi until Civil Rights Movement. This happened in the 1950s. Other monuments were built around the same time as the rise of the Klan in the 1920s. Again, you have to be careful precisely because this is an emblem of why collective memory is not memory. Because it's not that people are remembering. It's that they're writing a story about the past. Or to suit the political, social, cultural, maybe even psychological needs of the present.
And you make a point that history is very different. And if collective memory is about interpreting the past in light of the needs of the present, that critical history has a very different objective. Yes. What is that?
Well, first of all, I think there was a famous French historian called Marc Bloch, killed by the Nazis in after the occupation of Paris in 1940, who said, he was one of the great historians of the 1920s and 30s, and he said the greatest enemy of history is judgment, by which he meant that, you know, if you're really going to try to understand the past, your opinions about it are actually going to probably get in the way. And critical history is about saying it doesn't matter who I think the good guys or the bad guys were. I want to find out what it was like in that time, in those cultures. And you can, as a non, you know, in your sentimental life as a citizen, find this historical character very appealing and that historical character really disgusting. But if you're doing the work of history, you're being critical of everybody and everything. You're not trying to do what collective memory is about, which is building solidarity, building community, whatever the historical facts, they're massaged at best. I'm using a polite verb, into something that's helpful. It's like manufacturing heroes, most of whom aren't really usually that heroic. But it's the job of history to approach all of this, A, critically, and B, in terms of its own time, not in terms of our standards. I think, you know, one of the worst things that's happened in the woke decade, the last decade of, I've written a small book of my aphorisms, sort of anti-woke and anti-identitarian aphorisms, has just been published by a small press in the UK and the US. And so I've moved on to other kinds of trouble, but from the memory wars, but they're not unconnected. But collective memory is fundamentally about, as I say, solidarity, community. And critical history is about saying the past is really different, and judging it by our standards is absurd and indeed anti-historical. You know, you can
really try to understand it on its own terms, right? You're trying to, critical history is understanding it on its own terms.
On its own terms, and saying the fact that, I mean, look, if you, one of the things that's most revolting about the current American academic scene is that all of these people who've never heard a shot fired in anger are judging the past by the standards of the present and finding it wanting. This is, to call this childish is to insult childhood. That you're not thinking about the past as the past. There's a wonderful English novel called The Go-Between, got made into quite a good movie many, many years ago, which is all about an illicit romance. And the first line of the book is, the past is another country. They do things differently there. And the narrator looking back on this story that he's about to tell. Now, I think that's what's been lost. And so we get the confusion that somehow collective memory, which is to a large extent just what we want to remember, it's the ultimate kind of cherry picking, moral and intellectual cherry picking. You get, you know, you get your good guy, even if they weren't actually so good, and you get the people who don't satisfy your norms, even though by the standards of their own time, they might have been about as good as it gets in terms of their humaneness or whatever. I mean, think of capital punishment just as a dumb example. Commonplace example, rather. I hope it's not dumb. Until really recently, almost every decent person was in favor of capital punishment. It's really only in the last couple hundred years that you have really people of conscience complaining that this is unjust, this is wrong, etc. And of course, capital punishment itself is only outlawed in European countries, you know, half century, in the last 70 years, more or less. And it's still legal in many American states, obviously, and many other places, not maybe the necessarily the countries we Americans would like to be associated with, like Iran and China, but never mind. But the point is, the different one, that most civilized people, for all of recorded history, have been in favor of capital punishment. So if you're going to judge them because they fail to live up to our standards, well, then you just don't want to think about the past. You just want to make the past into either a kind of fairy tale or a cautionary tale for the things you believe in. And that's not history.
I get a sense, though, from reading your book that we're in kind of a no-win, or at least you're kind of critical both of the here and now, in that we have this critical history that gives us a chance to learn about the past on its own terms, but that's too hard. The people would rather not spend time doing that. And that memory has displaced history, that memory is everywhere. Memory is how people understand the past. And I don't know if that means that they're just getting it from popular culture. They're watching movies or whatever they pick up.
Oh, I don't think it's just that. I think they're getting it from universities. I mean, obviously there are egregious examples. I mean, there was that movie about Cleopatra starring an African-American star. Well, Cleopatra may have lived in Africa, but Cleopatra wasn't black. And it may not suit the current politically correct climate to point this out. And the lady who played the role, I can't remember her name, was incredibly indignant and said this was a great example of racism. No, what it was a great example of people saying that's not historically accurate. And listen, nor was it historically accurate in previous cultures to make everybody white. I mean, one has to be careful here. This is not the first time popular culture has distorted historical reality. I mean, that would be dumb. This is just a particular progressive, I'd use the word in scare quotes, version of these distortions. But of course, Hollywood has always distorted everything practically. I mean, there are very few realistic movies that you can think of among Hollywood movies anyway. And it's just which myths you're pushing, I think. I don't think, you know, I mean, I don't particularly care to talk about myself, but one sentence, am I in, you know, a sort of plague on both their houses kind of guy? Yeah, I am. My late friend Christopher Hitchens used to say, nothing if not critical. And, that's kind of where I prefer to stand.
I do have a sense reading your book. I mean, you're talking about how we see the past or in light of the present, you're writing about how we think about the past in a present context. And a lot of your book is anchored in a particular context. And so you're talking about, collective memory, and you do point out that there are certain types of collective memory that are maybe more dangerous than others.
Sure.
And I get a sense that there's an, in your mind, there's an evolution of collective memory, of how it's worked in the past in terms of maybe a top-down promoting national solidarity. I interviewed an art historian by the name of Erica Doss, who talks about end of the 19th century, early 20th century as the era of statue mania.
Yeah, that's true.
And more kind of traditional patriotic understanding who your heroes are and the great events. And then you fast forward to the present, and it's the era of memorial mania. And it's everyone that gets to tell their own story. And often those stories are people who feel like they've been left out, and they're often stories about grievances, right? And I get the sense that part of your reaction to collective memory is you're looking at how it's working in the present. It's always a dangerous thing. It's always something that needs to be dealt with delicately and within the right context, and maybe not at all in certain contexts, certain situations. But in the present, you have a lot of comments in your book, like, you know, collective memory is all about self-love, self-recognition. There's another quote where you're mentioning that it's something narcissistic. It's this part of this current age about instant gratification. So you have these comments in your book that it's the way collective memory works in the present. It's almost like it's connected to this selfish kind of culture that we have at present. People are too caught up in their own particular concerns and interests, and they don't really care about national solidarity. I don't know if that's a fair reading.
Well, I never thought of it that way, but I see what you mean. Look, I think we've entered, I'm in no sense the first person to talk about this, a culture of extreme narcissism in many arenas. Certainly history is hardly the only one, and probably isn't even the most important one. We've medicalized experience. We fantasize that it's an old American fantasy. It just has the current woke spin, which is basically you can be anything you want to be and anything you say you are. Hell, that's the premise of F. Scott Fitzgerald's The Great Gatsby. That didn't start with the trans movement. It starts with the idea that you reinvent yourself and that you're supposed to be accepted for what you say you are, whatever you actually are. That's what Gatsby's about. And that's what the trans movement's about. It doesn't matter what I look like. It matters what I tell you I am. Okay. Well, that's a kind of radical narcissism, individualism. That's very deep, I think, in American culture, and indeed, probably in Protestant or at least post-Protestant culture generally. It's a little less convincing to Catholics, I think. But there's no intercession. I mean, the reason it's more less convincing to Catholics is Catholics believe in priests, as you need the priest between you and God. Where the reason I call it Protestant or post-Protestant is because the Protestant idea is that there's nothing between you and God. It's you and God. I mean, there are pastors, of course, but it's not the same idea fundamentally, at least in, lower law. I'm not talking about Anglicanism, obviously, but Episcopalianism, but the other Methodism, Lutheranism, Calvinism, et cetera. I think we're in a deeply narcissistic age of wish fulfillment, where we take we don't see why our wishes can't become realities. I have this little anti-woke book or cultural criticism book. I don't know what it is. It's really just aphorisms and short entries from a Substack I did for a while, and I'm thinking I'll revive. Anyway, the title of the book and the title of the Substack is Desire and Fate. And it comes from a line by a Marxist scientist, British Marxist of the 1930s, called Desmond Bernal, J.D. Bernal, who wrote somewhere that there's the history of desire and the history of fate. And the problem is that man's reason, human reason, has never been able to distinguish between the two. Well, I think we're deep in that. We don't want to have fates. We just want to have desires, or rather, we want our desires to determine our fates, but it's not going to happen. And it can't happen because human life is, well, first of all, because it's finite, and second, because you're not in control. I mean, if you're in control, you're only partly in control. You're certainly not in control of, you know, how long you're going to, you know, when you're going to get that negative prognosis from the doctor and all that sort of stuff. So I do think we're in a period of where it may look like victim's culture, and on some level it is. But on a deeper level, it's what Christopher Lash, the great Christopher Lash, talked about when he talked about the culture of narcissism. Now, look, there's no going back. You know, the art historian you interviewed who talked about that period between what, the end of the American Civil War and the 20s is the great age of monument building. We can't go back to that. It's not going to happen. You look at even the best memorials, what would have been monuments 100 years ago or 120 years ago are now lists of names. You know, Maya Lin. I spend a lot of time in Ukraine nowadays, and it's fascinating that the memorials, and this is a country that in many ways has not, you know, is still very nationalist. It's not a period when people want to, you know, talk about how the national heroes are no good. It's quite the, or really we're lousy guys. In fact, you know, Lincoln hung the Lakota, that sort of style of argumentation. He may have freed the slaves, but he hung the Lakota, so he's obviously a monster. The Ukrainians are in full heroic mode of a country at war, a country fighting for its existential survival, in my view. I'm very pro-Ukrainian. I'm spending more than a third of the year there and have since the full-scale invasion. But the point is, their monuments are like Maya Lin's Vietnam War monument. It's some abstract thing. And then all the names. It's not the heroic soldier with his Kalashnikov or whatever, the way the monuments of the early 20s to our soldiers when they, you know, after the armistice to the World War One, the doughboys of World War One, that you had, let alone the heroic statuary of decades earlier.
People argue that's like a democratization of memory, the Maya Lin approach to the past, that people are engaging, they're leaving things there, they're participating.
It's incredibly moving. There's nothing wrong. I mean, I'm not critical of this. I just observe it. I think it is. Look, it's more likely, I mean, a monument, a heroic monument to a great general or even to a bunch of soldiers. I mean, there are a bunch of monuments, both in the period after the Civil War, the St. Gaudens statue in Boston Common to the 54th Massachusetts, the Black Regiment is soldiers. I mean, of course, it does have the Colonel Shaw at the front of them, but it's ordinary, for the most part, it's ordinary soldiers. But for the most part, monuments were a heroic figure or a bunch of heroic figures. And that does date, whereas names don't date. I mean, you go to a military cemetery, and I mean, unless you have some politics that precludes sympathizing, or unless you have a, you know, complete heart of stone, you're moved just by the names. It's not the monument that moves you. And that's what Lin, who is a kind of genius, understood, that this was going to be even more powerful. Of course, it's not triumphant. It's about people mourning their losses and acknowledging the sacrifice. But it's not saying it is a monument to a war that became very divisive, that I think many people supported, but many people opposed, and the memory of which, as we know from we're getting way off the topic, but as we know from how shabbily Vietnam vets were treated when they came home, I mean, even the people who supported the war didn't exactly go out of their way to, you know, vote for people, society that would look after the vets. The vets were ignored. They weren't treated properly. The VA wasn't equipped for the storm of PTSD and all the rest of it that was going to come out of a war that lasted more than 10 years of full-scale, large-scale American involvement.
I know you're spending more and more time on Ukraine, and you've covered so many conflicts in your career. I can't help asking your thoughts on this. So if this ends up, most likely it's going to be another messy piece, or whatever the outcome is. So is this a case where memory, and even you talk about justice in certain cases, that you can't have those things? If you're going to have, you've got to prior that the benefits of peace are going to outweigh any effort or desire for to look into things like war crimes, to keep alive memories of what happened.
But these are right now, we're still at the time of individual memory. I mean, people are in a war. You're not engaging in collective memory. You're living through it every day, and every day brings you.
But they're collecting. I mean, from the very start, you have cases like Bucha where you've got forensic experts. They're collecting evidence. They're preparing, you know, for future court cases. And that's part of, you mentioned Argentina and Chile and Spain. I mean, those are cases where you're trying to make international cases, and there's no statute of limitations. So maybe it's not today, but it could be 50 years from now or whenever.
It's possible. I mean, I think what matters about Bucha is, which I've been to a number of times, of course, but I think what's important is to give those whose family members were tortured and murdered there the information that's required, and to find out who the perpetrators were. Whether they'll go ever be in The Hague, I would be astonished if they ever were, but I suppose anything is possible. I don't think I'm with Mandela again. I think what matters is the historical record for the families, first and foremost, but for the society too, to find out what happened, to establish some kind of record. Whether this will lead to justice in the sense of, you know, a Russian officer going to jail in The Hague, well, I'd be astonished if that happened. But I don't think the fact that's not likely to happen invalidates the project. Quite the opposite. I think the project just has, you know, the central benefit of the project is something else. As far as the peace goes, look, is the likely outcome of this war that justice will not be, I mean, justice would be Ukraine getting all the territory that it's of, you know, up to its internationally recognized borders. Is that likely to happen? No, of course not. But there has to be a peace to make. And right now, it seems to me that Russia doesn't want any peace that isn't just Ukrainian surrender. And I don't think that nations have an obligation to surrender. I think that's a decision for them to make and their allies to make as well, of course, because obviously Ukraine depends on the aid of the European countries and of the U.S. and above all the U.S. and of Canada.
I have heard you say, though, that if you're going to have peace, that those soldiers who return, it's owed to them to have a better Ukraine in the future, yeah, to have to deal with a past, in that to recognize that this was a flawed place, that there were issues, serious issues of corruption, so that you have to deal with at least that past. But maybe there are other histories that are better left aside.
Well, the reason I keep saying this, and I say it a lot in Ukraine because I teach in Ukraine. I mean, I wouldn't say I'm local, but I'm a professor at one of the universities there now, and I'm there all the time. And even when I'm not there, I'm on, you know, on the phone and doing a certain amount of teaching by Zoom when I'm actually not in Kyiv or somewhere else in Ukraine or in Kharkiv. I mean, these people haven't fought. These people, it's one thing to fight the Russians and suffer and die and kill to rescue, you know, to preserve your country. It's another thing to accept the way your country was before you, this sacrifice was demanded of you. Ukraine was a horrendously corrupt country. It was ruled by an oligarchy that certainly did not have the best interests of the country at heart. I'm probably generalizing too much. I could think of it, one oligarch that I think probably did have, was a more benevolent figure in the Ukrainian social system before the war. But there were also lots of incredibly promising things happening in Ukraine before the full-scale invasion. But I think the soldiers will come home expecting a different deal than this oligarch-run, very corrupt society. And I've also made this comparison, which is to Britain in 1945, when the war ended, and Churchill had done this absolutely remarkable job leading, admittedly, a political coalition government to win the war against all the odds. And he was immediately voted out of office by what was called the khaki election, that is to say, by soldiers voting. And they wanted, it wasn't that they thought he'd been a bad war leader, but they thought the Britain he wanted was not the one they wanted. They wanted a fairer Britain. They wanted national health. They wanted a lot of stuff that a conservative government, they thought, wasn't going to give them. And I think you could very well get that in Ukraine when the war ends, and the war will end. All wars end. But whatever Ukraine looks like, I don't believe, I know a lot of these guys, I don't think they're fighting so these old oligarchic structures can just be put right back into place. And, you know, and soldiers' votes have a kind of different weight than some other votes.
I've taken more than my fair share of your time, David, but I have one final question that I'm just really curious to get your reaction to, because I was reading this article in the New York Times this morning. Of course, tomorrow is January 6th, and they were just talking about the success of Trump in completely rewriting the way January 6th has been remembered, and not just successfully rewriting it, but using it to, as part of his election strategy, really helped. It helped in his win. And I don't know whether, is this a clear-cut case where at least collective memory in the short run, there's a disservice being done to the past where you can clearly point out that this thing is being misremembered, that there is an actual memory could be tied into if you were misremembering something, like January 6th, that you could be undermining democracy, that this could be weakening of the democratic foundation. I'm just curious what your thoughts are. I mean, if you look at insurrectionists and then you relabel them as patriots who are, you know, unjustly imprisoned and need to be liberated. I mean, and that's the problem in the present, I guess, where we're all living in our own media universes, right? Where there's no consensus. And I work with people who are convinced that this was like an FBI plot.
Oh yeah.
What they saw on TV, they don't believe.
And
these are, you know, well-educated, intelligent people. So
lots of well-educated, intelligent people voted for Trump. I mean, that's a liberal delusion held in, you know, the Bay Area and, you know, and Old Town Chicago and Manhattan and Brooklyn that only dumb people voted for Trump. That's complete nonsense. Lots of smart people voted for Trump, and lots of people voted for Trump very consciously, knowing all his faults, but thinking that the current situation was simply intolerable, and that, you know, as often populist leaders win because it seems as if the established party people just won't acknowledge the problem, you know, which was, in my view, I mean, to the extent I'm not an expert on, you know, U.S. electoral politics, to put it mildly, but it seems to me that if half the country is suffering from really terrible inflation, and there's a sense in that the culture has gotten out of hand and is being dominated by very minoritarian tendencies, and that somehow seem to dominate. And the candidate of the establishment says she's campaigning on the basis of joy. Well, it seems to me the chances of you voting for the lever for her are pretty slight, whatever Trump is.
I'm not disagreeing with you that there are legitimate grievances. I'm just, to me, it seems like such a clear cut case of misremembering and the dangers of misremembering.
It is. But the problem is that, look, sometimes I think in my more peculiar moments, I suppose, that I ask myself, well, what will a Chinese historian in the 23rd century, back, you know, when all the dust is cleared and whatever our societies look like, they won't look like what they are now, and the political divisions won't be what they are now, and, you know, there probably won't be, if there is a United States at all, there'll be different one of the parties. Well, they can't tell me Democrats and Republicans are going to last 400 years in the same, you know, exactly the same
configuration. Yeah, but we're living in the here and now. So
yeah, exactly. So I think to myself, well, what will they say? What is this imaginary Chinese historian of mine writing about America in the, you know, in the second and third decades of the 21st century going to say? Well, it seems to me the first thing that Chinese historian is going to say is there was this political magician named Donald Trump who never should have been elected by any normal, you know, in the terms of American political history, he's a born third party figure. He's not the head of one of the two established parties. He is only the second guy to have been elected out of sequence, Grover Cleveland being the first. So presumably that Chinese historian of the 23rd century will say, well, who was this magician? And to have turned January 6th, which I don't think it was a coup d'etat, but it was an insurrection, all right. To have turned that into persuading the majority of the people that either your completely false interpretation of it is the correct one, or the fact that you had a false interpretation still didn't stop them from voting for you. I mean, that tells you something about how much this guy, call him some kind of political genius, call him just a guy who's got his thumb on the zeitgeist and just understands something about the way American people feel as populist leaders. That's, after all, what populist leaders, when they're successful, that's why they're successful. They're plugged into something in the you know, in the country that people feel, or at least enough people feel to put them into power. And the fact that January 6th couldn't have been disqualifying, I'm talking about for voters. I'm not talking about all the legal questions of whether or not he could have been convicted or why he wasn't. But I mean, just why did people either agree with his interpretation or disagree with it, but still vote for him? I mean, that tells me something about just what a strange moment this is, how alienated people are from the established parties, that a guy like Donald Trump can seem to people a better solution than anything else.
Or maybe that's a, maybe that is a case in point for the argument that you're making, that how the dangers of collective memories, how easily you can manipulate it. Oh, within just within a short period, within even a couple of years. Or,
you can manipulate it, but you see, it could also go back the other way. But the chances are, I mean, from what people say, he'll probably pardon the Proud Boys guy. I can't remember the fellow's name. And probably a few others. And again, you know, the Democrats with their colossal talent for building circular firing squads, you know, basically you'll have to shut up, just like they do about, you know, here you have a president who was in, you know, obviously in failing cognitive condition, and they covered up for him. This was the party that kept talking about Republican disinformation. You know, they, you know, you have to say they had their nerve. Speaking of disinformation, you know, you pardon Hunter Biden, you pardon your son, not only of the crimes he's accused of, but any crimes he might have committed during a decade-long period. And then you're going to complain about Trump pardoning the Proud Boy guy? Assuming he does it, I don't know. I mean, Trump isn't famous for caring about his subordinates for getting into trouble. So for all I know, he won't do it. But what do I know? But it seems to me that... It seems to me that for whatever you want to say about Trump, that the Democrats really cleared the road for him.
But there's definitely no thirst for to do the critical historical work.
Not now. Fact checking is for losers in this society, it seems. I'm sorry to think that, but that is what I think.
For suckers and losers?
Suckers. You know, there's this, because Trump, speaking of suckers, Trump is P.T. Barnum. To my mind, you know, I've never bought the fascist comparison to Trump, but I do think he's P.T. Barnum. And, there's a sucker born, as P.T. Barnum famously said, there's a sucker born every minute. And a well-intended, decent sucker, you know, not a, the sucker isn't the bad guy. It's just the person who gets fooled. And it looks like, you know, looks like we got fooled again. What can one say? I mean, you can't. I mean, I keep trying to figure out, whether the Democrats could have done anything differently.
Well, they could have had a primary, legitimate primary.
Well, they could have had a primary that would have required Joe Biden to withdraw in time for it to look, you know, for people to do it, and instead of basically just handing the ball off to Harris, reluctantly handing the ball off to Harris. I'm sure the Biden loyalists will now write 27 memoirs about how terrible Harris was, but you feel it coming. I feel it coming. But I mean, again, as you say, the great pessimistic German philosopher Friedrich Nietzsche said, there are no facts, only interpretations. And I don't believe that to be true, but it sure does look that way today. It looks like Trump's interpretation for the moment has won the day for a majority of Americans about January 6th, precisely.
Oh, definitely. No question. Sure. David, thank you so much for taking all this time to speak with me. Very generous of you.
My pleasure.
David Reif wears a lot of hats. He's a journalist, cultural critic, essayist, and policy analyst. Since the 1990s, he's reported on wars and humanitarian crises, from Bosnia and Rwanda to the Democratic Republic of Congo, Sierra Leone, Liberia, Israel-Palestine, Iraq and Afghanistan, to Ukraine today. I've been talking with him about his book, In Praise of Forgetting, Historical Memory and Its Ironies. If you've enjoyed this or other episodes of Realms of Memory, tell a friend or family member. The best endorsement is word of mouth. I'm Rick Tedarian. Thanks for listening.